Hi guys, very welcome back to the show, and I have a returning guest, and I was only talking to this man off camera. It's actually been 26 months since our last conversation, only felt like yesterday. I'm of course talking to Mr. Ian Douglas. He's a writer, he's wrote many, many books, which we'll get into, but predominantly we are here today to focus on this little baby, the Steve Kern Chronicles Volume 2. There we go, that's even better. I can just take the graph on the screen now. How have you been, man?
Doing very well. How are you?
Doing excellent. Look, a lot has happened since we last talked, but we're going to rewind a little bit, maybe for people that haven't seen the original interview. Basically, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am an occasional wrestling writer. I've written for Men's Health Magazine. I write for Barbend News, which is a fitness publication. I write for The Ringer every once in a while. I write for Cracked magazine every now and then. I write for Splice Today. And I've been very blessed and fortunate enough to write, to co-author several wrestlers' autobiographies and also write the history of pro wrestling in the Bahamas.
Wow. Look, we'll talk about wrestling then, and how did you become interested in wrestling, presumably as a young man?
When I saw Macho Man Randy Savage do anything at all, I was absolutely captivated by everything he did. When I had the good fortune of being, of co-interviewing, I guess, Lanny Poffo, I got a chance to tell him that his brother was the equivalent of Bugs Bunny to me Saturday morning. When other people were turning on cartoons, I was turning on wrestling, and I was always looking forward to watching a Randy Savage match. I thought he was the best.
Yeah. Fast forward then a few years, obviously, and you end up writing a book for, I think Dan Severn was your first book, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I was writing for for the West Michigan Sports Commission, for the State Games of Michigan. They gave me the freedom to interview whoever I liked for the adjacent blog. So I interviewed Kurt Angle, I interviewed Taz, I interviewed Dallas Page, as long as I could link it to something that had a connection to fitness or sport, I was allowed to interview that person. And one of the most logical connections was Dan Severn, because he was actually from the state of Michigan. He, of course, is from Coldwater, Michigan. And I reached out to Dan, and Dan was very time. I think he spoke to me for an hour and a half. I only needed 20 minutes. And I said, man, if he's that profusive with the dialogue, if you could rein him in for a set number of days, you could probably get a book out of him. And a few months later, he actually called me up and we had that very discussion. He said he was interested in doing a book. I told him, if you give me a few weeks, I think we might be able to get a book out of you. And we did. And that the result was the realest guy in the room, The Life and Times of Dan Severn.
Yeah. So he actually ended up suggesting it to you. What did that feel like?
Oh, it was wonderful. The fact that, you know, there would have been a moment in time where I wouldn't have been prepared to, I wouldn't have been psychologically prepared. I wouldn't have had the confidence to offer my services up for something like that. Where if he'd said, you know, I've been interested in doing a book for a while, do you think you could help me? I would have said, oh, no, Dan, I don't think I'm prepared to do it, but best wishes to you. I hope you find a suitable writing partner. But I'd already been through that thought process, and fortunately I was given the opportunity, and it was a fantastic opportunity and a wonderful learning experience. And once you get the first one out of your system, you learn everything that you're doing wrong. You file it away in the lessons learned file. If I had a subsequent opportunity, here are the things that I would do differently. And fortunately, I've had those opportunities as well, where I was able to learn from the first experience and come back and write better material, quite frankly.
And do you think if you and Dan never had that conversation, maybe we wouldn't be sitting here today after all the books you've written?
I don't think you would. Part of that is because of the relationships that are built. The first time you go into something, you don't know everything that can. You don't know everything that's attached to it. You don't know everything that comes from it. You may look at it as, oh, it's just a writing opportunity. It's this self-contained project. But in the process of learning how to go about it, I reached out to Kenny Casanova, who at the time had done Kamala Speaks and has gone on since to do, I think, 9 or 10 additional books. And he has been an invaluable resource. That was the first time I ever reached out to Scott Teal for anything. And Scott Teal has his name attached in one way or another between books he's co-authored, between biographies he's penned, between reference materials that he's put together, 30 to 40, maybe more projects. And once you're connected with that community, other opportunities come your way. Had I not done the Dan Severn book, there is almost zero chance that I do anything else related to not only wrestling writing, but mainstream writing, period. I know for a fact, the Splice Today, Ringer, Men's Health, Mel Magazine, Cracked Magazine, opportunities, they don't happen unless I take advantage of that first offer.
Yeah. Tell me, with all the things you have going on then in your life, like, where do you fit everything in? A bit like myself, I've got a lot going on, but what's your secret?
Man, I guess the two secrets. Number one is the process. And this is something that I think I had a decent handle on even before I became aware of the book Atomic Habits. The entire premise behind Atomic Habits is let's say one person wants to, one person has it in their head, like, I'm going to be in good shape. I want to get heavily involved in fitness. I'm going to exercise. But another person just makes it a regular part of their day, whether I'm in the mood or not. First 30 minutes of my day every morning, I'm going to spend in the gym and I'm going to exercise. Well, that person's 30 minutes a day over the course of a year is going to trump the other person's maybe 1 hour, one day per week. So just the fact that you get it scheduled, you get it on the board. Again, in the case of the most recent book, in the case of the Bugsy McGraw book, I'll go with the Bugsy McGraw book. I knew for a fact that every Tuesday at 11 for months, I was going to be on the phone with Bugsy McGraw. It was scheduled. Well, that's built in accountability. Like whether I do any sort of transcription, whether I do any formatting beyond that, there's the accountability to Bugsy that I'm going to be on the phone with you for an hour once a week until this project is done to our satisfaction, certainly to his satisfaction. It's his book. And so even if I haven't been doing everything I possibly could, I know that in 3 or 4, I may have taken longer than that, but that let's say 5 or 6 months, I'm going to have a book's worth of content out of him. And then it's my job to deliver upon that promise. And so just making sure I get something on the schedule to ensure that the content comes my way has been, I don't know that I necessarily call it a secret, but after that, the book almost writes itself because I feel beholden to the person for whom I've undertaken the project. And then beyond that, there's just a matter of happening to love writing. Like, the two things that I enjoy most of all doing during my free time are working out and writing. You don't need to beg me to do either one of those things. If I don't have something to write about, I'm going to find something to research and write about, and then I'm going to get it published somewhere. And if I'm my first opportunity. I'm a new father, but my son goes down. If I can squeeze 20 minutes of a workout into the gym, it's the best part of my day. I look at it like being a kid at recess. You don't have to beg me to work out. I look forward to it. So, yeah, my two dirty habits just happen to be fitness and writing. And there's some pretty safe and beneficial habits to have.
Yeah. So we'll take the wrestling hat off for a moment and just be yourself, the author, and try explain to other maybe viewers and authors that might be listening, what is it like working with pro wrestlers in general? Because me and you would have had conversations with a lot of people, and how would you describe people within the pro wrestling community to people that don't understand it?
And it's, wow. It honestly varies person to person, and it varies by generation. Like someone like Hornswoggle May, who grew up a wrestling fan in the national and international promotions, he assumes that you know that you speak more or less the same language. Like you understand what heat is, you understand what a mark is, you understand what kayfabe is. Whereas somebody from a prior generation, they won't necessarily have those same assumptions. And they may not even necessarily be comfortable with you using the insider terminology. So at least not so freely and casually. So you have to navigate that a little bit. But you know, also, I think the wrestlers I've dealt with have a general appreciation that you respect what they do and you're there to help them. Also, you're dealing with performers who didn't necessarily know what the business would evolve into, and they can be rather sensitive with their legacies in several respects. And what I mean by that is most of the guys I've dealt with, if they got into the business prior to 1985, a lot of them just said it was a way to feed my family. It was a way to earn a living that also seemed fun. It didn't seem like it was a real job. I didn't know that one day there would be all of this aggregated source material and suddenly my career would be evaluated and judged on the basis of how many championships I won, how many times I main evented Madison Square Garden. So some of them, and also if they worked in a territory that doesn't have a fully fleshed out history, a lot of their accomplishments and achievements have been lost in time and need to be recovered. So given the example of Bugsy McGraw, to a lot of people, Bugsy McGraw is a clownish wrestler who they saw with Jim Crockett Promotions in the mid to late 1980s, and they don't understand that he was at one point the most popular wrestler in the history of Pacific Northwest, with maybe the exception of Gene Kaniski. When he was the Brute, he was voted one of the most recognizable and popular figures in Canada. He was recruited to the Worldwide Wrestling Federation to main event against Bruno Sammartino at the Garden on the basis of his success that he was having in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. So for someone like him to have what he did prior to the 1980s, frankly, when he was a completely different wrestler, because until he got injured, he was a bit of a bump machine and then he was forced to transition to comedy. For someone like him to have the early stages of his career disregarded, I think he's a little bit sensitive to that. And it's just an unfortunate byproduct of a lot of footage simply being lost and us not having it around to appreciate it nowadays.
Yeah. I have built up this channel in such a way that I could have someone that's had hundreds of TV matches, et cetera, et cetera. And then I might have the one guy that only had maybe two tryout TV matches or something like that, never quite made it to one of the big promotions. But I think it's very important, and you'd probably agree with this, to kind of, the reason I do this is because I like to document everyone's story. I've had people that have never even had a match on WWE, people that have come in as extras, people that have worked behind the camera. I had a creative director a couple of days ago here on the show, and she spent 15 years in the WWE, and she had some fantastic stories that have never been told. So what I'm trying to do on this is just kind of document the business as best I can from talking to as many different people that were involved in this wheel of pro wrestling.
I think what you're doing is especially important because I'm not going to mention any names, but I had a friend who I worked with years ago whose lifelong dream would have been to be a WWE superstar. And he was right on the cusp of that. He actually appeared in a squash match on Raw. I'm not going to say when. I'm not going to say who it was against. But the percentage of people who start out with a dream of becoming a professional wrestler who ends up on international programming, who actually make it, is microscopically low. And I think in his case, it was devastating for him when he didn't get signed to a full-time deal. But sometimes you have to take a step back and recognize precisely how impossibly difficult it is even to be in a position to get on television for WWE, let alone get a match. And we tend to evaluate wrestlers nowadays by did you wrestle for a major promotion? Did you wrestle for a major promotion? What championships did you win? How many are you Hall of Fame worthy? And we ignore the thousands upon thousands of people who enrolled in wrestling school, wrestled for the indies, started with a dream. And there are different ways to quantify success for pro wrestlers in the wrestling industry, aside from did you wrestle for WWE and were you a champion?
I've had people that have had WWE matches that have got in contact with, just going through history. The internet's a great thing to find out lists of matches and who appeared where and blah, blah, blah. And there's actually been times where I've contacted guys that have had TV matches and they're like, well, why do you want to talk to me? And I'm like, well, you worked for one of the biggest wrestling companies in the world. I'm sure you got a story to tell, and off we go.
Yeah, if you had a match in WWE, you're already a step above. I mean, it's international television. You're already a step above anyone who was ever an extra on Law and Order or anything else. At least you had a character who was given some sort of development, even if it was only for that long. So if you're ever in that position, you are more important than you might think you are.
Yeah, you mentioned the Hall of Fame there, which we'll bring on Steve Kern. I think would be a fantastic addition to the WWE Hall of Fame at some point.
I think so too.
But and I'm sure it will happen. But in terms of the first book, The Kern Chronicles, do you want to fill the fans in on this what one? That kind of, the first one, yeah. What kind of, what, sorry, era did that cover firstly, and then what was the kind of critical response that led to the second book?
Oh, I'll take that in reverse order. When Steve and I first had the conversation about doing a book, he said, I'm kind of thinking I would do three volumes. And I said, well, hold on. Like, I think you're worthy of multiple volumes, but we need to see how this process goes. But I was going to treat it as, a case where we would start from the beginning of his life. We would go all the way up to the present day, and we would see how much material we had. And That was another case. We were going to speak every Wednesday at 7 p.m. for a year. He and I got started, I think, November of 2001. And wow. We kept going and kept going until, I think, January of 2023. And then I said, okay, I think we're at the point where we almost have enough for a volume one. There's a nice, neat little cutoff around 1987, 1988, when you decided you were done with pro wrestling for the first time and you were ready to give it up. The Fabulous Ones era had come to an end. So let's get a draft down. I'll get it over to you. You can take a look and see if there's anything that's absolutely essential that didn't make it in. There were a few anecdotes he wanted added. But after establishing that cutoff point, we were able to then focus in on everything else of significance that happened during that period. And the end result of that was the Kern Chronicles Volume 1, which I think is in the neighborhood of 420 pages. Now, even at that point, we probably had, if we'd gone to publication that day on Kern 2, we probably had a 380-page book already sitting there. But after Kern Chronicles 1 came out, we gave it some time. We gave it some room to breathe. We gauged what the reaction was. Regardless as to what the reaction was, the second book was coming out. We figured we'd give it some space and then release the second book sometime early in 2024. And as far as the response to the first book, it was incredible. The number of people who told me that they would rank it in their top five pro wrestling books of all time. This is not me blowing smoke. People have said it. People told me that independently. Plenty of people have told Steve that. And it's because Steve is such a phenomenal storyteller with such an interesting story to tell, starting with the fact that his father was a POW of both the Korean War and the Vietnam War. The fact that Steve went to school with Mike Graham, that he knew Hulk Hogan from the time that, and Dick Slater from the time that they were both kids, that owing to his relationship with Mike Graham and Eddie Graham being enamored with the fact that Steve's father was a POW, like everyone knew Steve's father was a POW and was still alive and was being held by the Viet Cong for years and years. Everybody knew that about him. It was in the press. So a lot of folks knew that story. Eddie sort of took Steve under his wing almost as his adopted child and helped to bring him into professional wrestling and treated him like almost like he was his own son for a decent stretch of time until they unfortunately had a falling out later on. But yeah, we start there. We go to the fact that due to the falling out he had with the Graham family, both Eddie and Mike, Steve was forced to sort of forge out on his own. He gets in phenomenal shape when he's wrestling in Georgia. He ends up in Memphis. He doesn't really want to be there. And then the Fabulous Ones opportunity sort of falls in his lap, and it ends up being this landmark tag team that reshapes tag team wrestling during the 1980s. So that in and of itself was just a tremendous story that I had the privilege of helping him tell.
Yeah. And for like a wrestler, like a lot of them, you'd know sometimes from dealing with people as well as I do that, sometimes they don't have the best memory, but obviously Steve has a very, very good memory considering the detail in those stories in the book.
Steve has a phenomenal memory, and for the most part, every detail, even even the things that seem completely outlandish and off the wall. There will be someone like Jerry Briscoe or Brian Blair or one of the Nasty Boys, plenty of other people who were present who can corroborate those stories. So, which is also a relief to me that I'm not just printing up a book of lies, that there are people around who could say, yeah, that actually happened.
I done something really cool with Steve when I had him on the show when we were promoting the last book. So when he was Skinner, obviously in WWE, his first opponent was Mario Mancini, who you done a piece with, I think. Didn't I introduce
you? From Mel Magazine.
Yeah. The Biggest Loser, was that what it was called?
Oh, man. I don't get to pick the titles for any of my stuff. It's always the editor.
He was happy with it anyway. But so me and Steve were having a conversation and I had this planned and I didn't tell Steve, but I was just like, right, here we go. And I popped Mario into the stream and then Steve could not remember his face. Obviously, he's changed over the years. But then as they were talking, and that was the first time that Mario had seen Steve since that day on camera. But now they've since went and done a few conventions together. Mario said that he's just the most fun to be around.
Steve's hilarious. It's funny you should mention that. I was actually with Steve. I'm not going to mention names. Steve might not care if I mention names, but he also might, and I don't want to test our friendship that much. I was sitting next to Steve at the gathering in Charlotte last year.
Okay.
And there was a wrestler who came by. I was sitting with Steve. I was sitting with Jerry Briscoe. I was sitting with Brian Blair. The Barbarian came by and said hi, and a few other people. And then someone else came by that Steve did not recognize, that given his history, you might have thought he should have recognized, and he didn't. And the person was upset. And didn't say anything to him right then and there, but Steve told me about it later and he just said, man, like, I've had thousands of matches with hundreds of opponents stretching back to the early 1970s. I'm 50 years removed from some of these guys. I simply don't remember everybody's face. So no matter how annoyed they might be, if they say, hey, remember when I wrestled you in Athens, Georgia in 1981 or 82, like, no, I probably don't remember, and you look totally different than you did back then.
Moving on then to obviously the second book, which we're here to talk about predominantly today. I have it here on the screen. So there we go. That looks better that way. So do you want to do a quick breakdown then of the timeline of this book? And obviously, judging by what you said, most of this was written back then.
Yeah, so the timeline of this book, it picks up in roughly 1988 when Steve is working for Coldwell Banker Real Estate and absolutely hating it. And he gets the urge, or then other factors were motivating him as well, but he gets the urge to try to get back into professional wrestling. Partners up with Mike Graham and Gordon Solie initially and starts a dual-branded Professional Wrestling Federation, but it was also known as Florida Championship Wrestling even back then. So it had this dual branding thing going on. And honestly, the first wrestling event that I ever attended live was in Nassau Stadium in the Bahamas, and it was a PWF event. It was the return of Dusty Rhodes to the Bahamas after a 10-year layoff, and it was right before he went to the World Wrestling Federation to wrestle in polka dots. But I got to see Steve Kern, Scott Hall, Mike Graham, Raven before he was Raven, Fred Ottman right before he became Tugboat and Typhoon, and Dusty Rhodes. And up until that moment, I didn't even know who Dusty Rhodes was. So that's how privileged and fortunate I was to be in the right place at the right time to experience that event. And that was a Steve Kern PWF event. And then there I am 30 years later helping him write books. It's just crazy how the world works. But yeah, he had the PWF going for years. It was a struggling venture. He starts hunting alligators simultaneous to that. And then he ends up getting almost raptured out of his struggling wrestling promotion and into the World Wrestling Federation as Skinner. And I won't spoil too much, but his story for how he becomes Skinner and how the meeting with Vince McMahon went was a very entertaining one. And from there, it extends all the way through his time in WCW, his time wrestling in the indies, his time in gym ownership and running a wrestling school in Florida called the School of Hard Knocks, which MVP Montel Vontavious Porter and a few others of note emerged from. And his time after he was brought in as a WWE agent, and then to the running of WWE Developmental in FCW, and then a brief period there in NXT as well.
He actually told me a story last time. Did he tell you the story about how he signed Omos?
Yes, he did. That's in the book. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's in the book.
It's in the book.
He goes up to him. I think it was in a restaurant. He said, "What do you do?" I play basketball. I'm not going to spoil it, but he's already said it on the show, but I won't spoil it. But that's another story.
No, it's fine. It's such a small part of the book. It's fine. Mm. Steve was at McDonald's and he was there to meet with somebody else who brought Omos along with him. And he asked, "What do you do?" And he said, "I play basketball." He said, "Well, I don't know if you could play basketball, but in wrestling, you got a future."
Yeah. I think he left it a few weeks and then he got the call and he's still there. Haven't seen him on TV in a while, but he is still contracted there. He's a massive dude.
We have a picture of Steve and Omos with MVP in the book.
Awesome. So what has the reaction been like then, obviously, to the second book? And do you think, because I know you're very critical on yourself and you have been in the past, but do you think this book is better than the last book? Or do you just see it?
They're two totally different books. It's very difficult to compare one book with the next because one is taking you from childbirth through the death of the indies. And then the second book, you're taking someone who thought he was done with wrestling, who knew everything there was to know about wrestling in the indies, and you're putting him into an entirely different ecosystem in the national version of the World Wrestling Federation, and then extending beyond that into WWE. I think the narrative of his life that where we have themes of fatherhood in the first book, I think that continues in interesting ways throughout the second book. They're impossible. They're impossible to fairly compare because the subject matter and the material is just so different. And the tone in a lot of cases is very different too. At the same time, I have people who reached out to me after the first book who said this was one of the best books I've ever read. And I'm thinking, well, shoot, the last thing I want to do is put a product out that's going to disappoint these people who were so looking forward to a sequel. And it's going to be so different. And I don't want them saying, man, Ian and Steve, I don't know what happened between book one and book two, but the second book is a disaster. So far, I've heard nothing things about the second book, which is very affirming, but also it's a relief more than anything because you can think something is good as an author, but you're also very close to the project. Mm. And then you reach the point where you've edited and you've reviewed it 5 or 6 times before it gets released. So some of the edge is taken off of it when you know precisely what's coming and also what got omitted. And you wonder if you made the right decisions in some cases. But so far, nothing but good things.
Yeah. That's actually a different type of pressure that I didn't really think about with the book. And then I'm thinking in my head, movie sequels, you know? And that's probably the worst example to give because there's not too many excellent movie sequels. But you alluded to your initial conversations about there will be a third book. So obviously the plan is to still release a third book, yeah?
No. This is it. Really? We completed the saga in 2 books. I hate to be, for lack of a better phrase, a size snob. But I don't want anyone who purchases a book that I'm involved in to feel cheated on style or on content. I want them to feel like there was plenty there for them to sink their teeth into. Mm. So, between the 2 books, we're at around 860 pages of content. I suppose if we were going to stretch this out, we could have attempted to do 300 page books if we were planning this start to finish. But I also think you lose something of the neat encapsulation of the content into the 2 halves of his life. So I think we made the responsible decision with the content. And I also think we made a responsible decision with respect to the consumers and their expectations that they're getting value out of this and not feeling like they got shortchanged in some way.
Okay, so obviously the next logical question is, so what's next for you in the wrestling world in terms of books?
I would never tell.
There is a plan to go forward with wrestling books though, yeah.
I am presently working on a book project. It is with a wrestler that most people know. It is at least 80% done at this point. There are a lot of factors that will determine when it gets released. I hope it will get released sometime in 2025. I'm not that I believe in jinxing yourself in any way, but I don't want to sound like a person who puts too much faith or stock in study results, but I have seen way too many wrestling writers and authors, the second that they reach an agreement to write a book with someone, they post it on Facebook, like, hey, I got a book coming out with somebody, and then it never comes to fruition. Well, you got all the likes right away, so when you posted the announcement, I'm sure that felt really good. And for some people, that's probably demotivating. Like, you got a lot of the positive affirmation almost as if you've completed the book when you announced that you wrote it. I would rather keep it entirely myself, keep the pressure on me to deliver the finished product without anyone else applying pressure, which is something I can talk about with respect to current 2, because there were some of those pressures. But I would rather keep it to myself. When the book is released, I also nowadays tend not to even announce that a book is coming out. It drops and there it is. And if you want it, you can go buy it the first time you hear about it. That's my preference. Then I get the joy of the announcement and the satisfaction of the book release all at once without the majority of the pressures.
Yeah. Happened to me one time, and I was working through a third-party music website in England, and they organized me an interview with Chris Jericho. So I put up interviewing Chris Jericho next week, and then third parties, it fell through, and I was like, right, not doing that anymore.
Yeah,
it's easier dealing with people direct, but then when you're working through third parties, I found sometimes that, yeah, it's kind of, that can happen.
Yeah, and in that situation, I'm sure you felt let down, and you felt bad enough, but then you feel like you let other people down as well for not being able to deliver. And I would just as soon avoid all of that. And when a project's ready, it's ready. When you find out about it, you can go purchase it right away. Mm. So yeah, take full advantage of the impulse buy as well. So they don't have to sit around deciding, maybe I don't want to buy it. Well, nope. Yeah. Link's right there. Go buy it.
And the book is exclusively on Amazon this time, isn't it?
It is exclusively on Amazon. Correct. And with respect to the pressure, I almost wish I hadn't put a volume one on volume one, because implicit in that is that additional volumes are forthcoming. And I had people reaching out to me saying wonderful things like, if volume two is coming out, shut up and take my money. Like, when is volume two coming out? I can't wait. Like, that's great. I appreciate it. I love that you loved it. It means so much to me that you enjoyed it, but I'm not telling you. I don't want you disappointed in any way. When it's ready to come out, you're going to find out with everyone else.
Yeah. What's the ratio like at the moment for physical copies towards e-copies?
I don't do e-copies. Refuse. I refuse.
So there's no e-version.
There's no e-version, and people get upset with that, and all I can tell you is that there is a website. I won't give you the name of the website, but anything that has ever been released on Amazon Kindle, you can go to the website right now and download it for free.
Yes, of course.
I'm not going to mention the author's name. He just came out with a wrestling book a month ago. It's a major release. It's doing extremely well. And you could find it for free without looking too hard right now if you wanted to download a copy, because it was available. It was available in a Kindle version. And yeah. I had someone reach out to me. Someone reached out to Brian Blair on Twitter last week and asked Brian, hey, Brian, are you ever coming out with a Kindle version of your book? And Brian tagged me and said, I don't know. I'll have to ask my co-author Ian Douglas about that. And I hopped on and I said, absolutely not, because I want to protect Brian's intellectual property. And everything that was released on Kindle, that I've seen get a release on Kindle is available for free download. So I'm not doing that.
Yeah. Excellent. I really, really appreciate that. That's nice. Mm-hmm. Good for the talent as well.
Yeah. Because I don't know if I mentioned it here. I've mentioned it other places. The only book I make a penny off of is this one. That's it. Mm-hmm. I give 100% of any profits from the books to the wrestlers, period. And so the only person whose money would be lost through the material being downloadable for free is the wrestlers. I'm not out of any profit or revenue one way or another, but the wrestlers would miss out.
So without mentioning the person that you're writing a book for, let's just put that person to the side. Like, I asked you this before, but is there anyone in the wrestling business? Because I think you told me, I asked you, who would you like to write a book for? I think you said Stone Cold Steve Austin.
But did I?
I think so. But if there was anyone that you wanted to write a book for that's currently in the business that you foresee having an amazing career, who would that be if you could pick them now?
Oh, man. CM Punk would be a fun one. I've had text messages with CM Punk, not about that, but that would be a fun one to work on. Drew McIntyre, who I love. I've been texting with Drew at least once a week for the last 2 or 3 months. He's hilarious too. But Drew's already had a book out, so
he's on top of his game.
I love Drew. I mean, my name is Ian Douglas. My dad is Scottish. That's an easy ethno. I mean, I'm Bahamian on the other side, Scottish on the other. That's just an easy ethnocentric pitch to make to me. But no, Steve is Drew. Drew already has a book out. Sheamus would be a fun one to work on. Never had a conversation with Sheamus. Natty Neidhart would be a very fun one to work on.
Yes.
Natty and I are very friendly, but we have not had serious conversations about doing a book. And like, frankly, I'd have to be under the WWE banner as a writer to even get those opportunities if they were doing something in-house, which is just a different, sort of system to have to go through, because I'm sure there are things that their talent might want to say that in a WWE product, they might not be given that sort of liberty to say.
Yeah. So we'll have to wait till they're off the books, so to speak.
Yeah. But so to speak, yes. But those are the, those are the wrestlers I'd be interested in.
So are you watching much of the product as we kind of wrap up here? Are you watching AEW? Do you read all that kind of stuff that's going on over there?
Depends what you mean by read the stuff. I mean, I have a lot of, it's amazing how much your crew of friends over the years, it starts to fill up with people connected with wrestling once you get involved with these things and wrestling writers and authors. So, Phil Schneider is a friend. Jonathan Snowden is a friend. And I got Oliver Bateman, like guys who are unequivocally better writers than I am. I will not hesitate to say that. And these are the guys who I bounce ideas off of all the time and solicit advice from all the time. And they are constantly commenting about everything going on in WWE and AEW. So I don't even feel like I'm required to watch it anymore to stay abreast for the most part of what's going on.
Yeah.
Becoming a father and quite frankly, between the majority of the work I do and then always having a wrestling writing project looming that I could be working on, sitting around watching TV just seems so irresponsible when you have, you know, you could be using your time more constructively.
Yeah. Yeah. You're saying like me, I don't really get to watch a lot of TV either, but look, what we will do is when you're ready to announce on the day or whatever way you do it this time of your next project, I'd love to have you back on to discuss it.
Maurice, it's always a pleasure talking to you. So it would be a privilege for you to be granted that opportunity to speak with you about it.
Awesome, man. I will put the link for the book underneath and any other books that are available on Amazon as well. Physical copies only. Thank you.
Maurice, it was a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Cheers, Ian.
Have a good one.